Hello, and welcome to the Popmatic Podcast. I'm Brian.
And I'm Crystal. We're librarians at Nashville Public Library.
This podcast is where you can find reviews and recommendations of the best books, movies, and music available for checkout from the Popular Materials Department of the Nashville Public Library.
You can also learn about library programs such as concerts, film screenings, book clubs, author talks, and book signings.
May we suggest some randomly good books, movies, and music? Heck yeah! For those into weird outsider art, I bring you the work of unconventional composer Harry Partch. Crystal will tell us about a musical outsider of a different sort in the likes of Benji Hughes. Books are next! Julie reviews The Help by Catherine Stockett. That book is so hot right now. If historical fiction is your thing, Amanda gives us her take on John Jakes' The Gods of Newport. Last but not least, Bill turns us on to the film work of John Sayles, and Clint gives us the recipe for the perfect spaghetti western with an appreciation of Duck, You Sucker.
I can't believe you listened to that.
Benji Hughes released his ambitious 2-CD debut last year called A Love Extreme. Hughes looks like a long-lost Allman Brother, sounds like Beck, and writes songs as funny as Weird Al. Whether he's poking fun at hipster culture or lamenting his troubles in love, Hughes remains musically savvy, writing absolutely unforgettable hooks. A Love Extreme is jam-packed with little snippets from Hughes' musical influences. A guitar riff from the Beatles' Revolution is in a tune called Vibe So Hot. And a melody sounding a lot like Deep Purple's Smoke on the Water is the hook in Hughes' ode to hotties called Tight T-Shirt. Some critics have found fault with this, but I don't have any problem enjoying these tunes. Lyrically, he's hilariously clever. Who would have thought a whole song could be devoted to your complaining neighbor down the hall? The date April 17th is mentioned 2 times in this 25-song set, and I challenge you to a lyrical seek and find. A track on disc 2 called The Mummy is sure to make it on Halloween compilations.
The committee, they asked me to be the one to pick the band to play the pawn. I said I want a Frankenstein. They said the Frankenstein was not a band. Could you get Dracula, whatever you do? Don't get the mummy. Don't get the mummy when the mummy gets drunk, he unravels. Don't get the mummy when the mummy gets drunk, he unravels. Don't get the mummy when the mummy gets drunk, he unravels. Don't get the mummy.
So if I haven't convinced you yet, check out Benji Hughes on YouTube, where you can find several live performances of songs from A Love Extreme. And now, for something completely different, here's Brian.
Harry Partch was an American composer, instrument builder, and music theorist who abandoned the equal-tempered chromatic scale in favor of microtonal scales. This put him in a one-man battle against the entire popular and classical music establishments of his day. The 4-CD set Enclosure 2 preserves a large portion of Partch's legacy, consisting of archival recordings of Partch's musical works, demonstrations of his tonal theories, and contemporary performances of select pieces. Enclosure 2 offers a glimpse into the idiosyncratic mind and often tragic life of an autodidact genius trying to survive in the American West during the Depression era. Always interested in the tonality of speech, Partch composed Barstow around graffiti he found written under a bridge in Barstow, California.
It's January 26th. I'm freezing. Ed Fitzgerald, age 19, 5 feet 10 inches, black hair, brown eyes. Going home to Boston, Massachusetts. It's 4, and I'm hungry and broke. I wish I was dead. But today I am a man.
Parch's intention was to capture the pitch and rhythm of natural English speech, as opposed to the formal, unnatural English typically found in the concert hall. Parch had ample opportunity to pick up very natural speech, as he was forced to live as a hobo and migrant worker through much of the 1930s. A testament to the strength of his spirit, he managed to keep writing music and building instruments through these years. Parch's journals of his hobo years were published as Bitter Music. Included on Enclosure 2 is an abridged reading of Bitter Music recorded for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Within the passage dated October 22, 1935, we find Parch at his poetic best.
I have thrown the petty, respectable life with all its comforts behind me after the effort to broaden and beautify it has destituted me and drained my stamina. All right, let me throw it behind without guile, without hoping either for a return to it or for a constant absence. After all, it did not request my efforts. The normal live body hopes for the respect and love of others, and enough of the world to bestow largesse. He hopes, and he abandons hope by turn. In the first there is fire to live, but in the second there is greater peace.
Later in life, Parch reestablished his ties with respectable society and found a small but extremely devoted group of admirers. He even had recordings released by Columbia Masterworks. His influence has only grown since his death in 1974. He inspired a generation of microtonal composers, and his stranger-than-fiction biography has turned him into something of a hipster icon. Check out Enclosure 2 for a different take on musical tonality and a view of American history from the margins.
I can't believe you read that!
Hello, gentle listeners. This is Amanda. Julie's back in the booth with me, and we've got a couple of interesting reads for you to check out this month. So, Julie, what good book did you find during your podcastic vacation?
Yep, I'm back, and I just read The Help, a first novel by Catherine Stockett. It's a story about what happens when silence is broken and social lines are crossed in a place and a time in American history where that just did not happen, Jackson, Mississippi, in the early 60s. Three women relate the events in alternating chapters. Two black domestic workers, Minnie and Abilene, and a young white woman, Skeeter, an aspiring writer. During this time, many white families in Jackson and all over the South employed African-American women to cook, clean, and care for their children even when the woman of the house stayed home. Naturally, these workers acquired a lot of intimate knowledge of these households, even though social segregation was strictly enforced otherwise. Skeeter writes a weekly column on housekeeping tips for the newspaper, although she knows nothing about cleaning since she lives with her parents who have always employed a maid. Instead, she quizzes her friend's maid, Abilene, for the information and then writes the column. From their weekly conversations, a small amount of rapport develops. Having been raised herself by a devoted maid named Constantine, Skeeter decides she'd like to write about the maid's experiences and feelings regarding their work and then compile their stories into a book. By pure luck, she finds a publisher in New York who expresses interest. Abilene reluctantly agrees to participate and to solicit others, including her best friend Minnie. Months pass before anyone else agrees to talk, even anonymously. Although everyone's identities, as well as the name of the town, will be disguised, they're afraid of being fired and blackballed. This is the same year that Medgar Evers is murdered in Jackson, and an atmosphere of fear bordering on terror permeates their lives. Skeeter and the women that Abilene eventually recruits must meet in total secrecy. As a measure of trust is established, more women agree to be interviewed at Abilene's kitchen table. As they speak of their devotion to the children and families they care for, and their simultaneous feelings of resentment and humiliation, Skeeter's understanding deepens, and her compulsion to tell their stories trumps the threat of jeopardizing her social status and friendships. Wonder what happens? Add your name to the library's request list for The Help and find out.
Well, Julie, I'll tell you what. This podcasting has been good to my to-be-read pile. You know, that pile of books you bought with every intention of reading, but you just haven't gotten around to them yet. Each month, I find something new in my ever-growing stack that I can finally take the time to tackle. For example, John Jakes' book, The Gods of Newport, has been waiting ever so patiently on my shelf since its release over 2 years ago. In addition, I just recently discovered that I am descended from the founding fathers of Newport, Rhode Island, so it seemed like I was meant to read this book right now. The Gods of Newport begins with Samuel Driver, a nouveau riche gentleman, railroad mogul, and former employee of the notorious ruffian Jay Gould. Recently made a widower through nefarious circumstances, Mr. Driver purchases land in prestigious Newport, attempting to raise his family's social station. Sam hopes to procure his daughter Jenny a wealthy husband among one of America's royal families, like the Astors, the Vanderbilts, or the Rockefellers. As the book progresses, a dichotomy emerges between the haves and the have-nots. Of course, our lovers are stuck in the middle. Prince Malloy, born into the working class, sets out to ruin Jenny Driver, but instead realizes he's become entangled with her family and her future. Jenny finds herself accepted into high society, but will she marry for love or for prestige? I thought this book was good, but I was a little disappointed that it didn't begin until after the Civil War era. Most of my relatives were already gone from Newport by then, and either way, they certainly weren't living in the big mansions of the elite few, unfortunately. If you're looking for good historical fiction, then look no further than John Jakes. Other books of his that I've enjoyed include Homeland, the North and South Trilogy, and my favorite, California Gold.
I can't believe you watched that.
This is Clint here with a review of one of the great spaghetti westerns. Sergio Leone's last and largest budgeted western, Duck You Sucker, has always seemed to be the left-out film from his staggering run of five westerns that he made consecutively from 1964 to 1971. Beginning with Fistful of Dollars, the film that shot Clint Eastwood to fame and also started the spaghetti western craze that saw hundreds of westerns coming out of Italy annually, Leone transmogrified a genre that many felt had gone stale. With his dynamic visuals and the music of Ennio Morricone, Leone brought the Western back to the forefront. Duck You Sucker, which was renamed Fistful of Dynamite to bank on the popularity of its breakthrough film, begins with a quote from Chairman Mao on the violence of revolution, which sets a different, more serious tone than the earlier Westerns. Though the earlier Westerns were not comedies, they were still so stylized that reality was practically thrown out the window. Duck You Sucker still has some of the lighter moments, but they are offset with a grimness that highlights Leone's grasp to show the true nature of the Mexican Revolution. For Leone, the intellectuals made the decision, but the common man suffered the consequences, which was usually death. Juan, played with a giddy robustness by Oscar winner Rod Steiger, is a bandito who bides his time with small roadside robberies until he can figure out how to rob the bank in Mesa Verde. His ace in the hole finally shows up one day on the back of a motorcycle. This is Sean, an Irish Republican Army demolition specialist played by James Coburn, who has made his way to Mexico to help with the cause. The title Duck You Sucker is the catchphrase that Sean uses when he blows things to pieces with his trusty dynamite. Juan, finally seeing how to blow the bank vault, forces Sean to follow him to Mesa Verde for the heist. Soon, though, Juan learns that he is not the one who is in control, and in one of the great scenes from Leone's films, he finds himself a reluctant leader of the revolution. As the film progresses, Juan accepts his new role, and we learn through flashback the situation that brought Sean to Mexico, and also what gave him his self-destructive streak. The two soon become friends, each learning that the world is much bigger than they are. Even with his David Lean-like scenes of grandeur and atrocities that are straight out of Goya's Disasters of War, Duck You Sucker is still at heart a kick-butt action movie. It is to Leone's credit that he did not allow his bravura action tendencies to be strangled by the social leanings of the material, and vice versa. Duck You Sucker was not a box office hit, and Leone only made one more film 13 years later, which was the flawed yet worthy Once Upon a Time in America. Leone, as with a lot of genre filmmakers, was not considered a great filmmaker in his time, but now we can see him for the true cinematic genius that he truly was. Now to Bill with a film that has absolutely no action in it.
The back of the DVD container reads, Seven Friends Who Reunite 10 Years Later After Their Radical College Days for a Dramatic, Poignant Weekend. I'm reviewing John Sayles' The Return of the Secaucus Seven, and you thought I was probably going to review The Big Chill. You might be surprised that The Return of the Secaucus Seven came out 3 years earlier and is sadly the lesser known of the two. The Secaucus Seven has a more significant role in film history because it literally ushered in the independent film movement of the 1980s. Before Spike Lee, Steven Soderbergh, and Kevin Smith, there was John Sayles. With $40,000, the money he made writing Roger Corman quickies with the titles such as Gun, Sin, and Bathtub Gin, Piranha, Battle Beyond the Stars, and Alligator. Don't you love those titles? Sayles decided if Roger Corman can make a low-budget exploitation movie, why can't I make a low-budget personal project? He took a 16mm camera, gathered friends he knew from his college days in the theater, and proceeded to make his movie. John Sayles said it best, Secaucus 7 is a movie where the philosophy was, I want to make a movie myself. Yes, it is an audition piece, but on the other hand, this may be the only time I get to do this. The characters are all about to turn 30 years old, and instead of selling out like the characters in The Big Chill, the Secaucus 7 are planning their second act in life. It's almost as if, while making this movie, John Sayles was planning his second act to his professional life, which was to continue making his own personal movies, which he has done since 1980. I can hardly wait to see what John Sayles has in store for his third act.
You've been listening to Nashville Public Library's Pop-Matic podcast. For more information, please visit www.library.nashville.org.
That's on the interwebs.
Yeah, you're live. Stop giggling.